You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. You gotta live on science alone.
Welcome to Unbiased Science, where we bring scientific method to the madness. We're your hosts, Dr. Jessica Steyer.
And Dr. Andrea Love.
And we are back for season two of Unbiased Science and are so, so happy that you're tuning in. This season, we want to explore lots of topics. And yes, we'll talk COVID because, you know, hello, global pandemic. But we'll also cover many other topics, including but not limited to artificial sweeteners, all things chiropractic, CBD, THC, diabetes, things like adrenal fatigue and leaky gut, which we get asked about all the time, crystals. And then, Andrea, I don't know, have you seen these videos that have gone viral of people eating and drinking certain things that make them poop out parasites? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
The parasite diet? Okay. Yeah. So we'll get into that and much, much more. No topic is off limits. If you're new here, we like to kick off each episode with a scientific question. And then we dig into the latest and greatest evidence and discern fact from fiction, or in our case, science from pseudoscience. So today's question is, what is the update on COVID-19 and variants and vaccine effectiveness? Before we get into that, we wanted to tell you guys that, yes, we're back with a new season, but we have the same partnership with Descent Pins. So in case you don't know, Descent Pins makes awesome pins, t-shirts, keychains, and more fun stuff that celebrates science, which you know we love. 50% of the profits from their science products are donated to Black Girls Code, DIY Girls, and Chick Tech. How cool is that?
And if you're like us, you support science. Show your support with the Science is Real collection from Descent Pins. It includes things like beakers, telescopes, and microscope enamel pins that show off what you know to be true. Science is real.
So get yours today at descentpins.com/science. That's DISSENTPINS.com/science.
And bonus, if you use discount code unbiased15, you'll get 15% off your order.
So speaking of unbiased, Andrea, I think maybe today we can kick off the episode with a very brief discussion reminding folks what it means to be unbiased.
So I just have to start because I know that there's a lot of people that listen to the podcast but maybe don't have social media pages, or, you know, they don't necessarily follow us on Instagram and Facebook. But one of the most common comments we get when we post things that are in fact data driven but people don't like is unbiased, talk about biased science, and
more like biased science, right?
and obviously, you know, there's a difference between not liking credible information because it doesn't align with your beliefs versus something actually being biased.
Mm-hmm. And bias in science has a very specific meaning. We do have a few posts on that. And honestly, we'd need an entire episode dedicated, you know, just to the definition of bias.
Maybe we should add that to the topic list.
I think we should. And again, it means, you know, it doesn't mean that we put out any and all information on a topic, because there's lots of bad information. So as scientists, we're trained to discern, you know, what is credible and what's not credible. And when we read a study, we're able to identify certain flaws and limitations that might limit the reliability, the validity, the generalizability of findings from that study. So what we're doing is we're kind of acting like a filter, and we are reading and critically appraising all of the information and the available evidence on a topic. And we're figuring out, you know, what is the best available information on a topic? And that is what we're presenting. So just because we're not putting out all information that's put out on the internet does not mean that we're biased. Again, we're doing nothing is totally unbiased, right, Andrea? But we do our best to present the information that's the least biased.
Well, and I think it's important to understand that being unbiased does not mean giving equal attention to all perspectives or all random opinions or points of view. You know, there are fundamental understanding and knowledge that we have that guide our ability to actually be able to interpret the data on top of the body of evidence. So, you know, if one random person with no scientific expertise is going to come out and say this outlandish statement, that doesn't mean that gets the same amount of airtime as 99.9% of credible data that is in total opposition to that.
Beautifully said. And so I think we need to dog ear an episode on bias. That'll be a fun one. Lots of different types of bias. Again, we do have several posts on this topic that attempt to just scratch the surface. I mean, this is something that we've studied for several years. but yes, that is a good topic for the future. So let's dig in, Andrea. What do you think?
So, you know, we've taken obviously a summer break from the podcast itself, but we've been very busy on social media, and we, of course, have not stopped posting updates on COVID. But things have changed since our last episode aired at the beginning of the summer. We ended last season with an update on the current treatments for COVID-19, and today we're going to get everybody back up to date with where we stand.
Yes, and to be honest, you know, we are a little tired. We're a little burnt out on COVID. I know we all are, but it only made sense to start off season two, just recapping where we stand. So as of September 21st, which is just a few days before we're recording this episode, there have been roughly 42.4 million cases of COVID and 680,000 deaths. Now, this is for sure an underestimate of the actual total of COVID deaths, right? Because we know that COVID manifests in different ways. It affects every one of our organ systems. And so things that may not even seem to be, I mean, I feel like I'm walking on eggshells here. Andrew, you might need to help me phrase this properly, but things like, you know, vascular problems, you know, people having heart attacks and strokes as a result of COVID. And so many of these things are likely going unclassified or misclassified as something other than COVID-19. So that number, that 680,000 deaths, is definitely an underestimation.
Well, and also, Jess, it's important to remember that in many places around the country, particularly areas that have low vaccine uptake right now, we're seeing the absence of available hospital beds. So there are people dying of things unrelated to COVID, meaning they're not dying because of COVID itself in themselves, but ultimately it is related to COVID because those beds are being taken up by COVID patients. So there's other people that are unable to get urgent medical care for things like strokes and heart attacks that are unrelated to COVID simply because there are no hospital beds for them.
That is a very, very important point as well. Over the last 14 days, if you look at trends, it seems like new cases have decreased by about 12%. I mean, we're hoping, we obviously just had this major spike as a result of Delta, which we will, of course, talk about. But the deaths, the daily death count has actually increased by about 36%. And we see that, right? Typically, there's a lag between a spike in cases and then deaths that follow, you know, typically weeks after a spike in cases. Let's talk about the world. So almost 5 million people globally have died from COVID-19. That's as of today. We're recording on September 24th. Switching gears a little bit, let's talk about vaccination. So as of earlier this month, about 55% of all Americans are fully vaccinated. Now, let's just qualify that. So again, fully vaccinated means that you're 2 weeks out after your second dose of an mRNA vaccine. or that you're 2 weeks out from your J&J vaccine. Now, when we say 55%, that number uses all people, all Americans. So that includes children in the denominator. If you talk about adults exclusively, about 75% of adults in the U.S. have received at least one dose, and just under 65% of the adult population is fully vaccinated. Now, Andrea, let's talk about vaccine efficacy and effectiveness. Can you define the two for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So efficacy, and often, you know, people use these interchangeably, but they are distinctly different. So efficacy relates to the effectiveness of a vaccine in a controlled, randomized clinical trial setting. So you have two distinct arms of participants. You have a placebo-controlled group, you have a vaccine recipient group, and you're looking at, in this small population, obviously it's not small, but it's smaller than the world, you're looking at the proportion of individuals who have the outcome of interest. So in this case, it's symptomatic COVID-19 in the placebo group versus those that develop symptomatic COVID-19 in the vaccine group. That is your vaccine efficacy. Now, based on those efficacy numbers, then you can ultimately submit those data for the FDA authorization and now full approval for the Pfizer vaccine. And once we start administering vaccines to the general population, now you're shifting into the realm of what we call effectiveness. So vaccine effectiveness is different because this is in real world circumstances where you don't have necessarily as controlled an environment. So you have differences in demographics among people who've gotten vaccinated versus those who have not. Whereas in a randomized controlled trial, you actually normalize for those. We have very, very similar proportions of these individuals. So very often, efficacy and effectiveness are similar, but effectiveness can be different because it's impacted by other extraneous factors that can affect how people's behaviors change, the risks they're taking, demographic shifts, and also simply the fact that you're vaccinating many, many, many more people than you are within a randomized controlled trial.
All right, so let's talk numbers. So obviously in the U.S., there are three approved vaccines. We have the Pfizer-BioNTech, the Moderna, and the J&J. Let's start with Pfizer. So back in December, Pfizer presented their phase 3 clinical data, and they showed that their vaccine had 95% efficacy, which is like unheard of, right?
And this, so this was efficacy against symptomatic illness. So
yep.
Having COVID and having symptoms. So I think it's also important to remember there's a lot of different parameters here. We have efficacy with regard to symptomatic illness. You have efficacy with regard to infection itself. And then, of course, you have efficacy with regard to, say, severe illness or death.
Mm-hmm. So then new data came out around April of this year, and they announced that the vaccine had about a little over 91% efficacy against COVID. Again, thank you for qualifying that, based on how well it prevented symptomatic COVID infection 7 days through up to 6 months after the second dose. And really incredibly, it was also found to be 100% effective in preventing severe disease as defined by the CDC, and then over 95% effective in preventing severe disease as defined by the FDA. So there was another study, not yet peer-reviewed, that provided more new data that brought the efficacy number down to about 84% after 6 months. But efficacy remained incredibly high against severe disease and was estimated around 97%.
Yeah, and there was, and again, this is symptomatic illness, and we know that Delta has changed the story a little bit. But even in the presence of the Delta variant, we're going to talk a little bit more about Delta soon, we are still seeing very high vaccine effectiveness against even infection itself. So a recent study just came out, and the CDC published it. This was amongst healthcare personnel, and they actually found that the vaccine effectiveness against infection was still very high. It was adjusted or averaged out to be about 80%. So that's against any sort of infection, and still obviously extremely high against symptomatic illness, severe illness, hospitalization, and death.
Well, and that's such an important point because I know this is something that bothers both of us. There's this perception now that the vaccines are not great at preventing infection because, you know, there's a lot of talk about breakthrough cases. And yes, breakthrough cases are going to happen.
Yeah.
But the vaccines are still highly effective against infection of any kind.
Yeah. I mean, 80% protection against infection outright. Particularly in the presence of Delta, which we know now has up to 1,000-fold higher viral load, meaning a person who's infected is spewing out 1,000 times more virus in their environment. That's phenomenal. And then, you know, on top of that, you have these multiple layers. So you have 80% against infection itself. Then you have above 90% against symptomatic illness. Then you have above 95% for severe illness. And then you have 99% for death. You know, I mean, it's they're still phenomenally effective.
So you brought up Delta. So let's talk about how effective, again, right now we're still talking about Pfizer. So how effective is it against variants? So in May, Pfizer released data that showed that the vaccine was more than 95% effective against severe disease or death from the Alpha variant and the Beta variant. So remember, Alpha was first detected in the UK. Beta was first identified in South Africa, and that was based on two studies based on real-world vaccinations.
And if you're keeping track of the original nomenclature, that's B117 and B1351.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Okay, Andrea, I think that you might be alone there, but okay. So then Delta, which was first seen in India, we have two studies that were reported by Public Health England. So again, using data from the UK, and remember that the wave of Delta hit UK before it came to the US. So that's where we have, the most data right now. And so those studies were not yet peer reviewed, but they showed that full vaccination after two doses was 88% effective against symptomatic disease and 96% effective against hospitalization.
Yeah.
And then everyone was abuzz because later Israel, which also saw, a major Delta outbreak, they reported that the vaccine's effectiveness was around 90% against severe disease and 39% effective against infection. And that was based on their population in late June and early July.
Now, I'm still skeptical of those data because looking at the new study from the CDC, this is the Heroes Recover data study. The vaccine effectiveness that we observed here in the U.S. was more aligned with the Public Health England data, showing that it's in the 80% range against infection, high 80s to low 90s for symptomatic illness, and above 95% for severe illness and hospitalization.
Well, that's a really good point. Andrea, looking to Moderna, so, you know, sometimes the studies will lump the mRNA vaccines together. Sometimes we'll look at Pfizer alone because Pfizer is the vaccine that is more widely used around the world, right? Mm-hmm. There's been some chatter lately comparing Moderna to Pfizer. Do you care to comment on that, Dr. Love?
So they're both highly effective vaccines. There have been some small studies recently that suggest that Moderna is a little bit better. And when they say better, they're looking at, for the most part, neutralizing antibody concentrations. But when you produce antibodies against the vaccine so that you're protected against illness, you sometimes produce more than what you need. There's a saturation threshold. So simply looking at antibody levels doesn't necessarily tell you if one's better than the other. We haven't done a lot of investigation about the cell-related components of immunity, such as memory B cells, which are kind of laying in wait to produce more antibodies if they need to, as well as our memory T cells. So it's very multifactorial. I would say, you know, we know that the Moderna dosage is slightly higher, so maybe initially it does lead to a greater, you know, production of antibodies, and maybe that wanes a little bit more slowly when you compare it to Pfizer. Whether or not that's going to translate to substantial differences in, you know, real world vaccine effectiveness, I think is still up in the air. We're actually in process of summarizing a recent study that's trying to answer this question. And it's also important to keep in mind that Pfizer was authorized before Moderna.
Right.
So your highest risk individuals, the people that were at greatest risk because of work-related exposures or because of underlying medical conditions, they were getting Pfizer first. So when you look at breakthrough cases, those are also people at higher risk to have breakthrough cases. So there's some confounding variables that I think we have to normalize to. Mm-hmm. So don't be disappointed if you got Pfizer. If you hear these, you know, headlines on the news, they're both extremely good vaccines.
Yeah, I think it's so ridiculous when the media does that. You know, it's like we're on these opposing teams and it's like, oh, Moderna's pulling ahead. Fantastic vaccines. You know, you got Pfizer, I got Moderna. I would have gotten any vaccine that, you know, was readily available. Yes. So,
and the funny thing is here, you know, there are all these other vaccines that are available nowadays. You know, for example, I'll use the rotavirus vaccine because I was talking to someone about that the other day. There are two different brands. I guarantee you don't know the brand your child got. You know, nobody aside from right now in this pandemic, and maybe me because I'm a nerd, ever knows what brand of vaccine they're getting when they go to get vaccinated. And I think this just, it's a problem when we're seeing kind of science unfold in real time, because you see how sometimes the conclusion or the big takeaway gets a little bit distorted by news outlets.
Ain't that the truth? Okay, I know we're going to talk about J&J in just a minute, but while we're on the topic of mRNA vaccines, let's pick your immunologist brain here. So the other thing, so obviously both vaccines have two doses. Mm-hmm. And for Pfizer, what is it, 3 weeks in between doses, and then Moderna's 4 weeks in between.
Yep.
I was reading that, you know, something about the how it's better to space, have a longer time in between doses, and that actually leads to a more potent immune response. Is there truth to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of truth, but again, it's really hard to say. You know, if Pfizer had 3 week and 4 week data to compare to, maybe we could say something about that. There is a process that our antibodies undergo as we're developing memory immunity called affinity maturation, and that leads to these antibodies that are are being produced to essentially mature. They mature, they have better binding affinity to the antigen. In this case, this is the spike protein of the virus, so that when they encounter it in real life, if you're exposed to the virus, it binds better. It may be a little bit more robust. It may be better at recruiting other components of the immune system. And sometimes that process improves with a little bit of an additional delay in vaccination, because each time you get a vaccination, you're basically activating your immune response. And so there's been a lot of debate within the immunology realm. We do know that some vaccines do fare a little bit better in terms of eliciting potent immunity if you extend that interval. There are other vaccines that you have to administer very quickly between the two. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag between the optimal immune response as well as the nature of the pathogen that you're vaccinating against. Now, with the Pfizer and the Moderna, a lot of the interval that was determined was based on the urgency of the pandemic, right? We wanted to find an interval that was long enough to elicit robust immune responses, but also close enough that you're not waiting 6 months to actually be protected when people are dying in thousands by the day. And so, you know, maybe that interval will change over time once we actually get the pandemic itself under control, if this does indeed become endemic. But at least right now, you know, we're considering that our primary vaccination.
So I feel like a lot of the people who got Johnson & Johnson often feel like
left out.
So let's talk about it a little bit.
I know. I feel bad. Now, you know, it's important to understand that we're not intentionally neglecting the people that got Johnson & Johnson, but only about 12 million people received that vaccine. It's really not being used ubiquitously around the world, at least yet. And a lot of the data we have from especially Pfizer is coming from other countries because they started vaccinating before.
Right.
And so we're building on that. So it's simply for the lack of data and the fact that the sheer numbers of people that were vaccinated with the other vaccines, there are orders of magnitude more of them.
So let's just recap. So back in February, Johnson & Johnson reported 72% overall efficacy and 86% efficacy against severe disease. Again, these are fantastic efficacy numbers. In August, J&J announced that new data showed that a booster shot at 6 months had a rapid and robust ninefold increase in spike binding antibodies in volunteers compared to 28 days after their first dose. Now, that data has not yet been peer reviewed or published in a scientific journal. So, Andrea, I want to pick your brain here a little bit. So I know we're going to talk about boosters, and Andrea sat in on all of the recent meetings, so she'll talk to us about that. But okay, so let's start with Johnson & Johnson. A lot of people who got Johnson & Johnson are saying, you know, should I go and get a Pfizer booster, a Moderna booster? What do you tell those people?
Well, it's really hard to say. So, you know, Johnson & Johnson vaccine is still very effective. You know, it's still the benchmark for authorizing a vaccine was 50% efficacy. And that is substantial, even at 50%. We're still seeing well above that. You know, we're seeing upper 60% for infection and, you know, 70 to 80% against symptomatic illness. And it's still very, very effective against severe illness and death, even if it's slightly reduced relative to the mRNA vaccines. Now, part of that could very well be due to the fact that it's a single dose. So yeah, of course, people want to know, should I get a second dose of something because it's available? Now, we don't have concrete data to say one way or the other. But there's a phenomenon called heterologous priming, which basically is a fancy word of saying that you give one brand or one type of vaccine against a pathogen for your first dose, and then you get a second different brand or different formulation for your second dose. And what that typically does is it, you know, primes and then boosts your immune response just like a normal booster would. In theory, this should not be dangerous. However, we do not have data to say it one way or the other, which is why the FDA cannot authorize it, and it's why the CDC cannot recommend it. We know that people are going out and getting different brands because of sheer availability. You know, we haven't been able to conduct a randomized controlled trial to investigate the different combinations. We know other countries are doing mixing and matching schemes, like in Canada, with no adverse outcomes. So personally, you know, if you're particularly high risk and you are in constant exposure and you got Johnson & Johnson and it doesn't seem like we're going to get any updates about a booster availability of that same brand, and it's going to give you peace of mind and you're willing to kind of take that risk because the benefit outweighs it, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to do that. But again, we try to be data driven here, and we just don't have data to say one way or the other.
And I'm going to come in with my little disclaimer that you should talk about this with your own medical provider if you have any concerns.
Exactly.
So a lot has happened. While we're on the topic of boosters, there's been a lot of activity, the focus being on Pfizer, because as Andrea just said, you know, that the Pfizer vaccine was the one that was first approved, right? So we have the most data on Pfizer.
Yep.
So was it the FDA's VRBPAC? Now, let me see. It's the
vaccine and related biological products advisory committee.
Okay. In beautifully in unison. So they met, I guess, last week. And yep. Again, we're reporting on September 24th here. And they voted unanimously to offer the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID booster vaccines to individuals 65 and older and those who are younger than 65, but at high risk for severe illness. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, that was 18 to 64, right? That was not...
Correct.
Okay.
So yeah, so that's actually an important point. So we know the Pfizer vaccine has been authorized for use for 12 and older at this point, right? Mm-hmm. But it's fully FDA approved for 16 and older. Mm-hmm. And it is authorized for boosters for 18 and older. So that's an emergency use authorization for the boosters. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that there are no data to suggest that adolescents, teenagers younger than 18, particularly because they've only recently started to get vaccinated, need a booster dose at this point.
Now, when the FDA met, they also were talking about approving boosters for people between the ages of 18 to 64 whose frequent exposure to the virus put them at high risk of serious complications, severe COVID, and of course, hospitalization and death. Now, interestingly, and you're the one who sat through these meetings, Andrea, so you jump in here with the details.
Okay.
But when the CDC's ACIP, when they met, and when did that happen? Was that yesterday, 2 days ago?
It started on Wednesday and it finished yesterday on Thursday. So it was a 2-day meeting of the ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the CDC.
And they signed off on those first two groups that we talked about, right? The people over 65 and older, and then people 18 through 64 who are at high risk?
They actually broke it down into four votes. The reason this was is because of all of the discussion about this. But they broke it down basically into 65 and older and those who resided in long-term care facilities. That was group one. That passed, no problem. The next vote was those 50 to 64 with underlying medical conditions. So those that could be higher risk because of various medical conditions, which we've detailed on our social media pages. That passed. The next was 18 to 49. So basically anybody 18 and older with underlying medical conditions. That one passed. And then the last vote was 18 to 64 based on occupational risk. So high risk because frequent exposure to COVID or because you work in congregate care setting or because you're frequently in contact with people closer than 6 feet and things like that. And even though this was technically authorized by the FDA, the ACIP committee felt that that was opening the door to a little bit too much vague language and that people who were, say, 18 to 30 with very robust immune responses who don't actually probably even need a booster might be going out and getting them. And there was a lot of discussion about vaccine equity and all of that. So they actually didn't want to do that. But the CDC at large, headed by Dr. Rochelle Walensky, actually decided to go and align with what the FDA said and expanded that to everyone 18 and older based on occupational risk. So boosters are now available to anybody immunocompromised. That's a separate thing that was already authorized, I think, over a month ago, as well as individuals 65 and older, and then individuals 18 and over with either underlying medical issues or high risk based on institutional or occupational exposure. So that could be teachers, that could be healthcare providers, that could be people who live or work in congregate care settings. So that could be shelters, it could be prisons, all of these places that we know can drive the spread of illness.
And so, Andrew, you just defined the different occupations. Then we're talking about things like, you know, certain medical conditions that are considered to put people at higher risk, right? So like cancer, COPD, kidney disease,
yep.
And also people who are pregnant.
Yes.
So have all of these things, I mean, we're still waiting for, like, what's the next step?
Yeah, I mean, people can go book their booster appointments. Now, it's important to understand, again, this is only for people who received the Pfizer vaccine as their primary vaccine. And for these people, this is 6 months or more after the last dose, so after dose two. So if you got your second dose in April, you're not due yet for a booster until at least October. But these people can begin booking appointments. Pregnancy is included because we know that pregnancy affects your immune system, so you don't reject the fetus. So you do have a little bit of immunosuppression. We know that pregnant people are at much higher risk for severe COVID outcomes. So the benefit of a booster does, you know, offer them that advantage. Now, again, people that fall particularly in the occupational or institutional risk, they really need to consider their own personal risk level. Like I said, an 18-year-old who works at a mall and maybe is interacting with a lot of people, but is always wearing a mask and their county has a mask mandate, you know, that might not be a person that needs to go get a booster. But say there's a teacher who's, you know, in their early 60s and they're in elementary school, so there are no kids that have been currently vaccinated. Maybe their county isn't enforcing mask wearing in the school. You know, that would be somebody that I think it makes a lot of sense for them to go get a booster dose.
Okay, so what about the time frame for, well, there are a few other things I want to chat about while we're talking about boosters, but what about boosters recommended for kids? We're not there yet, right? Right.
Correct.
Okay.
So kids have very, very potent immune responses. We know that these vaccines elicit really, really high levels of antibodies in children. We know that children are only recently being vaccinated compared to the first round of individuals who are vaccinated as early as December 2020. So yeah, kids are not there yet. I would be very surprised if we see that at any point. I think the biggest thing, aside from boosters, is getting everybody who's unvaccinated and eligible to get vaccinated. So get the kids 12 and older their first rounds of vaccines. We know that the EUA for 5 to 11 year olds is probably coming soon. So once that's available, get those kids vaccinated. Boosters are not going to take the place of getting as many people vaccinated initially as possible. Boosters are just going to offer additional protection to people who are already protected.
So Andrew, I mean, you just brought up kids under the age of 12. So I have two kids, a 3.5-year-old and an almost 5-year-old. And between seasons 1 and 2 of Unbiased Science, my kids did return to school. And on day 2 of school, school was shut down because there was an outbreak in my son's class. If you follow us on social media, you probably saw me weeping on our Instagram stories because it was just, you know, it was obviously very scary, and it's you feel terrified as a parent about sending your kids in. And anyhow, I'm waiting. I'm counting down the days until the vaccine is approved for younger kids. Obviously, everyone wants to know about timelines. We don't have the, you know, a black and white answer. I think we expect that it'll be approved for 5 through 11 year olds sometime in October. I think we're hoping for before Halloween is what I've heard. And then the younger kids under the age of 5 is not expected, I don't think, until like December 21 or mm-hmm. even January of 22. Is that the timeline you're hearing?
Yeah, and I think it's going to be, so there's kind of three chunks. There's 6 months old to 2 years old. There's 2 to 5, and then there's 5 to 11. So I think it's going to be the 2 to 5 year group that we will get toward the end of the year, early next year. And then the 6 months to 2 years old is probably going to come after that.
Oh my God. I cannot wait. Okay, let's move on. Can we talk a little bit about the prevalence of Delta? And well, actually, even more than, well, Delta is everywhere, right? If mm-hmm. If you have COVID right now, it's almost certainly Delta. What is it? 98.6% of all U.S. cases.
Yeah, and that's a steep jump from just a few months ago. In the week ending June 19th, which is 3 months ago, it was only 35% of the cases in the U.S. So Delta has very quickly outcompeted all of the other variants of SARS-CoV-2 in the country.
So what about other variants? What are we talking about? Mu and Lambda? What are you concerned?
I mean, Mu and Lambda do have some concerning mutations, as does Gamma, which was quite prevalent in Brazil. A lot of the similar mutations that we see with Delta are seen in these things that, you know, maybe enable the virus to more effectively infect our cells, to replicate a little bit faster, to avoid our immune responses a little bit. And all of those things lead to things like increased transmissibility, possibly more severe illness and things like that. But Mu has not been able to get a foothold in the U.S. It actually is declining at this point. It's now only about 0.1% of cases in the country. Delta is really where it is. You know, I think, I don't know if we'll ever get fully 100% Delta, but it's gonna hover in that realm. Delta is a superior adversary compared to the other variants that we have right now. Now, that doesn't mean that a new variant can't crop up and outcompete Delta. We know mutations occur as the virus spreads. We know the virus spreads more amongst people that are unvaccinated because vaccines also reduce infection rates, which ultimately reduce transmission rates. So there's still a huge emphasis on getting people vaccinated because as long as this virus is spreading, there's still the chance for new variants to emerge.
Speaking of variants, there was a weird, I don't know, conspiracy that we don't actually test for variants. And so this is all a lie. I know. So no, you know, if you do test positive for COVID, you as an individual, you won't know which strain of the virus you're infected with, right?
Correct.
Although now it's a very safe assumption that it's Delta. But we do, the CDC takes some of the samples from the laboratories, right? And they'll do their own testing and they do, you know, it's probability sampling. So it's not every single test that's done goes and, you know, and they do the test for variants, but there's a sample of tests that's taken and that gives us an idea of what proportion, you know, is Delta and then these other variants.
I mean, exactly. And it's local health departments too. So basically, when people are getting COVID tests, you know, those samples are collected to say whether or not that person is infected. And we're using these little probes. But then you still have that sample. And so we can do what we call genomic surveillance, which means we sequence the entire length of the virus genome instead of just a little piece to see if it's there. And we can actually determine what strain, which variant it is. And so, yeah, these local health departments, the CDC, a lot of organizations around the country do this with certain proportions of positive test results, and they can surveil and say geographically, you know, regionally, which regions have which variants and in which proportions. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, an individual is not going to know, oh, I have the Delta variant, but we know population level wise which variants are predominant.
Right. And of course, the samples are taken from all over the country, right? Yes. So we want to see which strains are more prevalent in the South versus the West, you know, all that.
Exactly.
All right. So, Andrea, we get the question all the time, why should I get the vaccine if I can still get COVID, right? You know, there's a lot of attention on breakthrough cases, and some people don't see the utility of vaccines. So mm-hmm. we already talked about the first very clear reason, which is that there's a significant decrease in the likelihood of infection. The vaccines are very effective at preventing infection. Next, I think there's been tons of attention on the fact that the vaccines are extremely effective at preventing serious illness. So the majority of people who we see hospitalized and as well as those who unfortunately die from COVID, the majority of those people are unvaccinated, right?
Mm-hmm.
The two other things we haven't talked about, one, you are definitely going to have to talk about it, but viral clearance. So if you're vaccinated, you clear the virus more quickly, right? And then the period during which time you're contagious or infectious is shortened. Right?
So essentially, you know, first is, of course, we've heard a lot of people use what we call the base rate fallacy to kind of skew the data and suggest that more vaccinated people than unvaccinated people are getting infected. When you have a population, let's, you know, use the extreme for hypothetical, but if 100% of your population is vaccinated, then any cases that emerge are going to be amongst vaccinated people. So you could skew that and say 100% of new cases are amongst vaccinated people, but that's not the real story. You have to look at proportions. You have to look at rates. And so you have to normalize that to, say, 100,000 individuals. And when you actually normalize that, we know that new cases are predominantly amongst unvaccinated people. Now, there are going to be vaccinated people that get infected and get symptomatic illness, and ultimately there will be the rare instances where people have severe illness or death. But the proportions and the numbers of those are much, much smaller. On top of that, those that are vaccinated that do get infected tend to have lower viral load. Now, there was an initial study that suggested that wasn't the case, and we're actually going to talk about that on social media in the near future, but there's a difference between residual RNA, because your immune system has cleared the virus, versus actual reproducing virus. And the study that was citing that was not actually assessing whether or not those viral remnants could actually reproduce. So the data we now have suggests that not only do vaccinated people have lower viral load if they do get infected, but they carry the virus for a shorter duration, even if they do get infected. And the reason for that is their immune system is already prepared to recognize that virus, and they're actively clearing it, whereas a person that's unvaccinated, it takes many, many days for their immune system to ramp up and get activated in order to clear it.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, because they're clearing the virus faster, even if they are contagious, they're going to be contagious for a much shorter period of time. So overall, if you compare a vaccinated infected person to an unvaccinated infected person side by side, the risk of you getting sick from a vaccinated person is likely to be much lower than from you getting sick from an unvaccinated person.
And all of these things taken together make the very clear case that vaccines do prevent transmission, right? Because they're
yes.
making it less likely that you're infected. And then if you do get infected, they're shortening the period mm-hmm. during which time you are actually infectious. You have a lower viral load. So all of these things do. It's so frustrating to hear.
I know. It's like, it's one of these things, like, it's 80% effective at preventing infection. If you can't get infected, you cannot transmit the virus.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, Andrea, I feel like we covered a lot of ground here.
We did.
I would be very, very curious if any of the people who are listening right now, if you have not yet been vaccinated, if you haven't and you're willing, you know, please do send us a message where we really would be very curious to understand why it is that you are still, is it a matter of hesitation? Is it a matter of access? We'd be very curious to hear. So please feel free to reach out to us. Andrea, do you want to take us home?
Sure. So thanks for joining us today on our season 2 premiere. We hope, like we did, that you had a good summer off. Although technically we didn't actually have the summer off, but we hoped you learned a thing or two today. And if you like our pod, please share with your friends and family and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget, you can also access all of our previous episodes, our infographics, and we even have a searchable database for sources on our website now at www.unbiasedscipod.com. You can also pick yourself up some merch or you can leave us a donation. Next episode, we are actually bringing a guest on and we are going to answer the question, are artificial sweeteners really harmful? We will, of course, continue to provide updates on COVID-19 on our social media accounts. So be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Unbiased SciPod. Catch you next time on the pod, your trusted source for no nonsense, just science.
Yeah. Oh, I am a scientist. I am a scientist. Yeah, I am.